Welcome to Stories of Safety. In this podcast series, we will talk to the people who have shaped healthcare safety. We will explore the stories, science, and policy that have shaped how we think about, manage, and measure the safety of healthcare. This series is funded by the National Institute for Healthcare Research and brought to you by the Patient Safety Research Collaboration in Yorkshire and Humber. I'm Jane O'Hara. I've been a patient safety researcher for over 15 years. In this time, I've come to understand how complex healthcare is and how difficult it can be to answer one seemingly simple question. How safe are we and how can we improve? In this series, we will be exploring this deceptively simple question from all angles with people who have helped shape healthcare safety in the UK and across the world. In this episode, we are talking about systems. In patient safety, we are increasingly talking about systems, but what are they? What does it mean to take a systems approach? How is this different to what has traditionally been done in healthcare safety and improvement? And importantly, what methods and tools are available to help us take a systems approach to safety? To do this, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by one of the global experts on how to look at systems, an award-winning human factors academic, Professor Pascal Karayan. We're delighted you can join us. So a little bit about Pascal. So her research belongs to the discipline of human factors engineering, and in particular, something called macroergonomics, which hopefully we'll get into a little bit. Her scholarly contributions are aimed at modelling, assessing and improving work systems to improve system performance, safety and worker well-being. Her research has been funded by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes for Health, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, the US Department of Defence, various foundations and private industry. Pascal was elected to the National Academy of Engineering in 2024 for application of human factors engineering to healthcare systems to improve patient safety. She is a member of the International Academy of Quality and Safety in Healthcare, elected in 2020, a fellow of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society, a fellow of the International Ergonomics Association. She has received multiple national and international awards, and in 2020 was named a National Associate of the National Academy of Sciences. So I'm delighted that you have found time amongst all of that stuff, Pascal, to speak to us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the nice introduction, Jane.
Well, as I say, it took me a while to reduce it down to just that. It's an incredibly impressive legacy. Yes, thank you. Okay, so what I've been doing in these podcasts is trying to start with a bit of a sense of place. So I understand you were born in Marseille in France. Could you tell me an interesting fact about Marseille?
Ooh. The interesting fact is actually this is a city that I happen to be born in. This is not where I'm from. Part of my family was in Algeria when Algeria was French many, many years ago. And the other part of my family is from Corsica. So we're very much from that part of the world. And I just happened to be born in Marseille. This is where my parents went after leaving Algeria. And this is an interesting city, but I don't think I would want to live there, maybe. I don't know. I like that. Well, I'm very much from the southern part of France, as you can tell from my funny accent. But as you know, I've lived in the US for most of my life. So this is that funny feeling of belonging to multiple cultures, including, of course, the southern part of France, but also the US.
I mean, a fascinating kind of back history there, which hopefully we'll talk a little bit about. But I did a little bit of internet searching on its history, and it seems to have been one of the centres of the movement to sort of support workers' rights within France, and a sort of city of rebellion, as it's sort of come to be known, and historically left-leaning outlook. And I was just interested whether that had any sort of influence on your choice of research interest when you first started out.
God, that's an interesting question, Jane. I actually left Marseille when I was about 20 to go study engineering in Paris, because that's kind of what you do in France. You go to the big city to continue. Many people do that to continue their studies. But it's an interesting fact that you pull out about Marseille. And it's actually interesting because it's related to the state of Wisconsin, which is in the US, where I lived more than half of my life and where I also studied, and I was a professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Actually, the state of Wisconsin is the state in the US that has been the place for many laws and regulations to protect workers' rights. Years ago, I remember when I was a student, there was a school for workers at the University of Wisconsin. The law regarding workers' compensation was actually came out of the state of Wisconsin. So it's an interesting fact that you dig out from Marseille that's related to the other part of my life in the state of Wisconsin in the U.S.
Maybe you've been drawn to these places as a result of
absolutely.
Some sort of subconscious rebellion in you. I love that. Yeah. Love that. So you've mentioned that you went to work in Paris and then you moved to the U.S. in the early 1980s. So what prompted that move for you?
Actually, I was in the U.S. much earlier than that. When I finished my engineering degree in France, I ended up at the University of Wisconsin to do a PhD. I don't know how it was for you, but I had no idea what it meant to do a PhD. I thought it was interesting, you know, to continue learning. And so that's what I did. I was extremely lucky to end up doing my PhD with Professor Smith, Michael Smith, or Mike Smith, who was my PhD advisor and became a colleague and a dear friend. So I ended up being hired by the University of Wisconsin, where I did my PhD. But then in 1995, I guess, I decided it was time to go home. And I'm putting home in quotation mark, and home meant going back to France, which was, again, earlier on I talked about different cultures, which was a cultural shock because I thought I was coming home, which was not really the case given the time that I had spent in the U.S. in 1999, when we ended up back in the state of Wisconsin at the university. My husband, Peter Hunaker, was also offered a job at the university, so we both decided to go west, to go back to Wisconsin.
Amazing. So a lot of sort of transatlantic moves there.
Yes.
So across your sort of the early part of your career, it sounds like you were really focused on sort of industrial engineering and in particular the experiences and impacts of work stress. And I was fascinated to learn this about you because that's exactly how I started out. I did my PhD on using the Karasek model of work stress. So what were you broadly interested in the time? Why were you drawn to that area of research?
So I've always been interested in organizations, organizational issues. As an engineering student in France, I studied economics, business, management, and that's kind of the track that I was supposedly gonna do until I decided to go to the US and do a PhD. When I did my PhD with Mike Smith, that issue of organizational factors and how they impacted people and their safety and their health and their well-being was something that he had worked on for quite a while. And so as an engineer, it was kind of a weird combination to be anchored within engineering. And I really have my 2 feet in engineering. I mean, I'm an engineer, I'm a designer, but I'm very eclectic in terms of disciplines that I'm interested in. So I took classes in psychology, of course, organizational psychology, but actually I was more attracted by sociology of occupations, of organizations. So very early on, I dabbled into all of that literature, business, management. And so it was kind of a strange thing to be an engineer, to be doing human factors research and be interested in organizational issues and job stress. At that time, that didn't quite fit. And that's when I discovered microergonomics, and then I found my home.
So it's almost as if you were interested in work stress, but in the context of the organization rather than as an individual sort of experience.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was the perspective of Mike Smith. He had spent quite a number of years at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, understanding the concept of job stress. And actually, Bob Karasek, that you mentioned earlier, was funded by the program that Mike led at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. So understanding those factors, you know, job demands and workload and job control, role ambiguity, role conflict. I mean, those were things that I learned very early on in my studies as a PhD student. I actually did my dissertation on job control and autonomy, again, as an engineer, someone in industrial engineering and in human factors. That was kind of an unusual combination. And it, many years later, it all came together.
I can see a theme here, slightly bucking the trend, slightly rebelling from the get-go. Love that.
That sounds right.
I love that. So how and why did you start getting interested in patient safety research?
So actually, when Peter and I went back to the US in 1999, I was given the opportunity to start new research. And in the first part of my career, I had done a lot on job stress, but also looking at the role of technology, information technology, and its role in creating more stress, in mediating it, moderating it, and so on. So one day, someone knocks on my door. It was one of my colleagues, Patty Brennan, who has also an interesting background as a nurse and industrial engineer, and later on became the director of the National Library of Medicine at the NIH in the US. And so Patty knocks on my door and said, I think I found an interesting project for you, Pascal. It's about looking at the impact of EMR. This is how we called it at that time, electronic medical record. There is that guy, Paul Smith, a family doctor, who's going to implement that technology in his clinic. He wants to do a study. I said, oh, yeah, sure. I know a little bit about IT and IT implementation and impact of IT. So that's actually how we started. That was our first study. At that time, not many people were talking about IT, health IT, EMR, EHR. But Paul Smith, that family physician, was very keen about making it a success, the implementation of that technology in his clinic. So we worked with him. We did a lot of research, collected a lot of data, but also worked with him and his staff to try to help with the implementation and the integration of the technology in their processes. So that was one track. The other track is, you know, 1999, 2000 is when the famous reports from the Institute of Medicine came out. So there was a lot more interest in healthcare and patient safety. A lot of meetings were organized. The US Congress started putting money into research on patient safety. So we were keen about being part of that conversation. And then the third piece that I should mention is, you know, we talk about industrial engineering. My department was actually renamed later on Industrial and Systems Engineering. This is a department that was a pioneer in application of industrial engineering in healthcare. Two people, Patty Brennan and Denny Freiback, who are members of the National Academy of Medicine. So this is a very unusual department of industrial engineering. So I was kind of in that environment of people interested in healthcare. And so all of these factors combined then give me an opportunity to look at patient safety and to apply for different grants and get funding for research on patient safety.
So it sounds like you were really well placed with your sort of emerging interest in an idea of engineering in a macro way, a system way, and then this sort of emergence of the identification of the problem of patient safety, the need to improve it, the burden of patient safety incidents that was coming out at the time. And those two things sounded like they came together. So I'd like to talk about systems, if we might do for a little bit, because you're the one of the most expert people, I think, in patient safety on this. And you've done such a large amount of work on this over the last few decades. And the word seems to be everywhere. We talk about systems in patient safety. It's in patient safety policy and practice. I'd really like to hear from you, and if you could explain to our listeners what a system actually is. Like, what do we mean by the word system?
I think the one thing that I would want people to remember when they hear system is interaction. I think you're absolutely right that there is a lot of use of the term in all kinds of different contexts, by all kinds of different people, different disciplines, and so on. My perspective comes from my discipline of human factors and ergonomics, which sometimes I call human factors engineering. You know, I replaced the E of ergonomics by E of engineering. That serves my purpose of being an engineer. And so that perspective means the person is in the system. The way we describe the system is as having elements, and so the person performing tasks, using different tools and technologies, and all of that happening in a physical and organizational environment. And you know, that idea of describing the system with these different elements can be applied to all kinds of situations, including what we're doing right now. You know, you and I are talking, exchanging information. We're using different technologies. You are in your physical environment. I am in my physical environment. And then we have an organization around us. So once I've said that the system has elements, you know, the elements are important, but it's how they interact that actually creates opportunities, challenges, barriers, facilitators, and all of these interactions between the different elements of the system also change over time.
So if that is a system, what does taking a systems approach to improvement actually mean? And how might that be different from other types of improvement?
You know, it's interesting because systems thinking actually belongs to all kinds of disciplines that are very different. Some are highly quantitative, of developing quantitative models of the system. Some are more based on basic quality improvement and the PDCA cycle, and I could go on and on. The way I tend to look at it is, let's try to understand that entire system. And once we understand that system, which is, I think, a big thing, is by saying these are the elements of the system and how they interact, I think that allows people to get a foot in the door of understanding what the system does instead of what I think or what someone thinks the system is. You know, that idea of work as done and work as imagined. You know, once you start looking at the real work and its complexity, there are many, many different factors, and that can be really challenging. At the same time, to me, it kind of opens the door to improvement, but it's a continuous process. It's not easy. It's tough. And that process, I've used the term of human-centered design to describe that kind of the toolbox of methods and tools and techniques that we use in addition to the SIPS model to analyze the system, come up with an intervention, implement it, evaluate it, and then continue that, those feedback loops and the continuous improvement process.
In 2006, based on lots of things that you were working on at the time, including the balance model, you publish with colleagues a paper that describes a way of looking at the system in the way that you've talked about there, which was part of the System Engineering Initiative for Patient Safety Program. And it became known as you've said there, the SEEPS model. And I'm reliably informed from the SEEPS 101 paper that it is SEEPS, not SIPES. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, there are all kinds of different ways of saying it.
Yes. I thought this is probably the one thing that people can get from this podcast more than anything else is how do you say Seeps? Is it Seeps? Yes, Pascal Carine is saying it's Seeps. Perfect. So could you tell me about how this framework came about, how you came to sort of develop this way of seeing systems and this model?
So one of the key theme of everything that I've done is collaborations and team and multiple disciplines. And as you look at the group of authors of that paper, you're going to see a bunch of engineers, people in human factors, people who in nursing, so Patty Brennan. So you see all kinds of different people bringing their different perspectives. You know, your question early on about what a system is, we all came to the discussion about coming up with a model with all kinds of different definitions. So it took quite some time. And the end product ended up that SIPS model that combines the WONK system model that Mike Smith and I had developed many, many years ago. It was actually published in 1989 with the Donabedian model or structural process outcome. And Maureen Smith, who's a health services researcher, brought that to us because we're talking about quality and safety of healthcare. And so then suddenly we started putting all of these pieces together. And of course, we, you know, we're strong believers in feedback loops and learning, improvement, adaptation. And that's how the model came about. And I have to say, one of the reasons we were able to do that was because we had received funding from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. You know, I mentioned earlier that in the early 2000s, the agency received quite a lot of funding from the U.S. Congress for research on patient safety. And we got funding from that agency to create a developmental center for research and education in patient safety, DSERPs. And the agency funded about a dozen of these centers. And ours was the only one anchored in engineering agency that had huge vision. And they thought, well, we're going to give a chance to that group over there at Wisconsin, bunch of engineers that want to do patient safety. And so that grant gave us an opportunity to do a lot of different things, including having those conversations about what became the SIPS model. And so the SIPS model is really build on that in-depth collaboration between these different perspectives.
It's really interesting that you talk about wanting to sort of seek out those multiple perspectives and get that collaboration and seek new understanding from different places. It's absolutely the way that I like to work, and because I'm not entirely sure that one discipline on its own can ever sort of solve a problem or even understand the problem in the first instance.
You know, Rebecca Lawton,
yes,
who you know very well,
yes,
wrote a paper that I really like where she actually just say that. You know, I think sometimes there are people who say, you know, I got the answer. You know, you're never gonna hear me. You know, you have to use SIPS. SIPS is the answer. No, I mean, SIPS is a way of thinking about it, but we need a lot more. We need other things. And if you have other tools, other ways of thinking about it. And Rebecca in that paper really made that strong point that the problem is way too complicated to think that there is one approach or one model or one framework that's going to get us to a better world, I guess.
I'm so glad you said that. That's absolutely something very close to my heart. I think in some ways that in academic settings, we use different lenses, different theories, frameworks, different paradigms even to examine the problem and come up with different ways of maybe solving or certainly addressing some of the problems. And so we can sort of move between these things in a way that I think sometimes in healthcare practice, people want a definitive answer. And I think sometimes that's the challenge, is that certainly in my experience of working in healthcare, that actually that fluidity can sometimes be a challenge for people, Could you just sort of give us a real summary about the central thesis of the SEEPS model?
The person is at the center of the system. The person can be a healthcare professional or worker, a physician, a nurse, a unit clerk, a technician, a pharmacist, patient, care partner.
And that's a really important thing, isn't it, to think more broadly. We call it patient safety, but in doing so, it's sort of, it was rightly a movement that sort of, I think, brought to the center the fact that actually patients weren't passive, that there was all of this iatrogenic injury and all of that sort of stuff. But actually seeing it as healthcare safety, the safety outcomes for all those involved in the system. Obviously, the patient as recipient of that care is probably, you know, the first. But actually, we do need to think about the safety of the other protagonists in those processes as well, I guess. So that's a nice sort of counter. I think listeners in England are going to be particularly keen to hear from you is because, of course, the SEEPS model has been recommended in the most recent NHS England guidance on responding to patient safety incidents. And it says in that policy, organisations are encouraged to use the national system-based learning response tools and guides or other system-based equivalents to explore the contributory factors to a patient safety incident or cluster of incidents and to inform improvement. And I'm interested in your take on this and what suggestions you would have for people working in safety within organisations who are using it for incident response rather than improvement.
When that patient safety incident response framework came out, it was, wow, they're mentioning SEEPS, that sounds great. And then quite a number of people started contacting me, you know, can you give a presentation on SEEPS, which I very happily did. And then I quickly realized that, and actually that's one thing I'm afraid of, is SEEPS being confined to analysis of incidents or events. And actually, that's not how we designed it. And then there are many other great tools and methods and frameworks that have been developed to look at incidents. You know, you had Charles Vincent, I mean, the London Protocol and the revised updated version that he and his colleagues published not long ago. I mean, this is just a great, great framework. So that, I mean, that was interesting that SEEPS was mentioned in that context, but I hope that it doesn't stay there, that people think about SEEPS also as a way of not just analyzing the problem, but moving forward with understanding what could be the solutions, trying things out, thinking about an intervention or a change as actually a system change. So using SEEPS to do the next step of designing the intervention, using SEEPS for designing the intervention, using SEEPS to think about the implementation, and then using SEEPS for the evaluation. So that's kind of what I'm afraid of, is SEEPS being confined to a framework for analyzing incidents, which I think is great. Again, I mean, this is fantastic. And there are many other concepts that need to be integrated in that process. Hopefully, SEEPS can also be used by people to do the next steps after doing an analysis.
It seems like you developed it to sort of guide the design of systems and the understanding of how things are working rather than necessarily just a sort of retrospective look back. You know, and I think it's important for our listeners to take this point that actually it can explore the problem, but it can also help identify solutions and also provide a sort of framework for a scaffold, if you like, for evaluating those solutions as well. There are now three versions of the SEEPS model: SEEPS 2.0, SEEPS 3.0, and also the SEEPS 101. What are the main differences in those versions?
The increasing understanding of patient and the role of patient in the system. You know, in the 2006 paper, we talk about patient as a section, but I think we do a much better job in SEEPS 2.0 to clearly identify the different roles that the patient can have in the system, including the patient walk system, the collaboration, and then system where the healthcare workers is the primary stakeholder. And then the SIPS 3.0 with the patient journey, because, you know, that's another thing I mentioned it earlier, is patient safety is tough when you look at, you know, one particular unit or one particular setting, but this is not the way patients experience healthcare. They may be in the ICU or in the emergency room or visit their primary care physician, but their experience is a journey. You know, they move between different settings. They do a healthcare at home. And so understanding that complexity, I think, has been an important feature of SIPS 3.0. And then the SIPS 101 was our desire by Rich and I to tell people you can do it.
Sometimes I think we get so hung up about, oh, am I doing it right? And actually, it's kind of like, if you start to think about the people, you start to think about the work processes, you start to think about the tasks and the technologies and the things that sit around, you're beginning to think about the wider system. You're not just thinking, I will introduce this protocol and this will solve all our problems and I don't care if it raises new ones. You know, I think thinking in that sort of basic way about the system can lead you to understand that even small changes have these multiple ripple effects that can be really good, and you might anticipate them, but they also might be not so good, or you might not even understand them because people absorb that change and work around and adapt to kind of create a status quo. So I think just engaging in asking these questions is the kind of 101 that you're talking about there, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, that's what I think you used an important term of basic. You know, that's what I mentioned earlier. We could use the work system and its elements to describe what you and I are doing. And so I think helping people understand that, you know, this is pretty basic, using those elements and then asking questions about each of them. This is the way to get started.
When I've spoken to people about systems in healthcare, it quite quickly turns into a sort of panic. And it's words, the terms, but more, I think, as you've said, the overwhelm. It's almost like when you start to scratch the surface and unpick everything and surface all of the things that people are doing to work around problems, or where this has been badly designed or that or whatever it is, it can quite quickly feel just like, you know, where do we start? What do we do? Is this a real impediment to thinking in this way and trying to use system-based improvement, do you think? And is there anything that we can do as people supporting practitioners that might support them to do this?
I persist in using the term system, which then I very quickly describe in people doing things with tools and in a physical and organizational environment. Okay, I said it pretty quickly. And then help people understand that if you do that type of analysis, it's a commitment to probably understanding that something was wrong that you did not initially. You know, you're going to uncover things that you had not anticipated, which is great.
I think the term I often think about is an analysis paralysis. So I'm doing some work at the moment in maternity. And as you know, in the UK, maternity is a big issue and lots of people are feeling very vulnerable and there's a lot of emotion and sort of trouble in that area. And it's not just that you get overwhelmed. It's also you wonder to what extent the system is ready to uncover all of the risk that people are actually holding all the time, because they're trying to juggle, you know, work design problems and lack of staffing and cultural issues and all of that sort of stuff. And I think it's not just the paralysis comes from the analysis, it's actually what happens when you do tell people, and do they want to hear it? And what do they do with it, I think, is a real challenge. Your work on SIPS 2 and 3 was really, as you said, to bring the patient and family into the center of your concept of the work organization and the work system. And the sort of most recent version of SIPS 3.0 explicitly talks about designing for and understanding the impacts of the patient journey across healthcare. And as you know, I've been long interested in the experience of patients and how they support patient safety, not just receive the sort of outcomes of patient safety. And you sort of talk in that paper about, and rightly, I think, that safety issues are often the most acute at the interfaces between the work systems that we set up or the organisations or services. How might taking an approach like SEEPS 3.0 be used to reduce those problems, those risks across the patient journey?
Now, I'm going to tell you a little story about one of the very first projects that we did. There were a lot of people in healthcare and patient safety. Why did you pick that? Well, you know, it was opportunistic. One of our colleagues, Scott Springman, an anesthesiologist, was actually walking, trying to figure out what was happening to patients arriving on the day of their surgery. So, you know, outpatient surgery, they come in the morning, they leave in the afternoon, it's less than 24 hours. So he was wondering where those patients were coming and arriving at the surgery center, and there was information missing, there was some test they were supposed to do that was not done, and all kinds of other things. And surgeries were canceled, patients unhappy, and so on. So we actually ended up walking with Scott Springman and many other people to understand the early phase of the process. What happens before the day of surgery? So we ended up talking to the surgeons and the surgeons, people in the surgeon's offices, in primary care. We ended up following patients when they came for multiple visits between the outpatient surgery. And then one day we said, okay, we're going to put together in a meeting. We brought together people from the outpatient surgery, anesthesiologist was there, the prep clinic, people from the pre-op clinic were there, people representing the surgeon's office, and there were like 6-7 people. We put them all together and we started talking about our research and our findings. And at one point in time, all of us researchers were silent and the people were talking to each other. Why do you do that? Oh, but I do that because ta 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 ta. And they starting understanding each other, the other's perspective, that there was something that was done in the outpatient surgery, in the pre-op, in the surgeon office, whatever it was, that affected the others. And so understanding that they were part of process. And that then became really clear early on in that project. And this is a theme that we try to work on in all kinds of different projects. And then understanding that idea of process from the perspective of patients. So, you know, we've done quite a lot of research in emergency departments. And an emergency department is kind of a place where a patient arrives and a patient leaves. And so you can do a lot within that context. But if you don't deal with the before and the after, you're not going to have a lot of impact. And that's where the transitions, the interfaces between systems then became really important. Doing that type of research where you look at interactions is tough.
It is really tough. I mean, even as we've struggled to look at certain things because ethics between primary care and acute settings it's like almost set up so that you can't look at the interfaces. There's no data on outcomes between those two things. All of the outcome data is centered in these organizations. So those gaps in between are like these sort of black holes of data. And it's almost like the only way to really understand that is to understand the patient experience within that and get information from them. It's so interesting. You're saying so many things that resonate with me, Pascal. It's so brilliant because, you know, when I've talked to people about systems, it is you have to look at the entry and exit points. You can't just look at your system. And so much bad improvement work is done because you look just internally within that system and not, okay, how are people and things and processes and referrals coming in and what are you leaving and what are you giving to the next part of that system that causes risks. And transitional care is, I think, such a great example of that because so much of that risk is put onto the patients to carry outside of the process. So really delighted to see your work and in preparation for this, looking at the role of patients as knowledge brokers, because it's almost like they plug the gaps in those structural kind of safety gaps that we create, and therefore so much of that risk is held as they sort of move around the system.
You know, that was a really interesting side study to do on, you mentioned that paper on Knowledge Broker that Catherine Wurst, one of my PhD students, did. But that's that project where we looked at what happens to older patients who come to the emergency room and they leave the emergency room. So we looked at different transitions, in particular the transition back home. And one of the people who walked with us is the spouse of a patient who had been to the ED, I want to say, I think at least 15 times. And I was really privileged to learn a lot from her. And actually, one of the things she mentioned, in the US, we very often talk about caregivers as the family members. And Paula said, you know, I'm not a caregiver, I'm a care partner. And so this is what you hear me use that term of care partners. But understanding really the role of patients and their care partners. And again, I think figuring out that balancing act where you want to get them involved and meet them where they are in their need and wish of getting involved or getting engaged, but at the same time, not putting too much burden on them. And that's kind of the conversation that we had when we wrote that paper on knowledge brokers, is the patients and the care partners have a lot of great information. At the same time, how can we avoid putting too much burden on them that they have to fill in the gaps and filling the holes and close the gaps? I think that's the tension. And I think that's probably a follow-up to that paper that we should write about one of those days.
I'll happily join you in that one. And it's almost like, okay, let's have an adult discussion. There are gaps. So what can we do in the meantime? But let's not leave it there. Let's try and reduce those gaps. It's a good interim measure, recognizing their role and their importance, but it should be a defense, not something that we rely on, because we can't fix those sort of structural safety gaps that we create, partly because we don't take their perspective. So I think that's one of the real strengths of centering the patient in the middle of that work system, is actually you start to see the world from their lens and understand how the system is working. And I think that's been my sort of perennial kind of thing. You can't understand safety unless you're actually understanding the safety work that patients and care partners are doing to keep themselves safe, and in acute settings keep other people safe. I mean, often they do things in wards to keep other people safe, which I think it goes unrecognized. So my final question on this is, do you think it can ever really be designed around the patient, and how might we get better at doing that?
Well, I think with more people bringing that voice, like you're doing and other people are doing. And I don't know how it is in the UK, in the US, more and more healthcare organizations have patient and family councils or advisory boards. And that's kind of the way to bring that voice, but also trying to figure out how to bring that perspective in the work of improvement, in the work of analysis and the work of improvement. And so I think it's really figuring out how do you bring those different voices, different perspectives, and whether, of course, the patient, the care partner perspective, the healthcare worker, and then, of course, I speak for my own discipline and bringing people who come from human factors and ergonomics who bring a different lens to the analysis.
You know, you're such a significant part of this human factors legacy as a discipline. And I'm really interested in looking sort of back at it and then forward to the future of human factors. And I was reading your paper on balance theory and the work system model from 2009, your retrospective. And in that, you mentioned that in the 1980s, the HFE community paid little attention to large system issues, especially in the United States, but that systems have been much more recognised and common in Europe. Do you think that there have been different central traditions in the use of theory in the US and in Europe within healthcare?
Yes, I know. You know, that term of microergonomics that we used early on in our conversation is really a US term. Had Hendrick wrote a very famous paper in the 1980s to help the discipline understand, look at all these changes that are happening in society and demographic changes and so on. And so we need to understand We need to go beyond what he called the micro ergonomics, you know, looking at the specific interaction between a person and a specific task, specific part of a tool, and look at broader organizational and system issues. And at the same time, the term that was used, that had been used in the UK, systems ergonomics, you know, Tom Singleton wrote a famous paper years ago. And so there were these things happening in different countries. I should mention France too. You know, my training, my engineering training is in France. My human factors training is in the US. But I'm also, I feel very connected to the French ergonomics tradition of understanding the whole work, the job that people do, including not just the micro interactions, but the broader context. And of course, what the French ergonomics discipline brought to us of understanding what they call tâche et activité, so the real work as done and work as imagined, which is now the term that has been used. And so there were all these different traditions that, you know, have a lot in common of understanding bigger chunks, not just a task and a person, but multiple people, the team. And I think that has changed a lot since I started. You know, I mentioned earlier when I started that idea of looking at job stress and work factors and organizational issues was not really mainstream. And now look, this is the conversation we're having, no? about burnout and well-being of healthcare workers and how that Indeed. Relates to patient safety. So I think this is good news that we're arriving at a stage where those system issues are accepted in at least the discipline of human factors. And I think in healthcare, we still have a long way to go, but we're making progress.
Well, indeed. I think there's been a lot more recognition, certainly within the UK, of the need for people in healthcare to be specifically trained in human factors. I think a lot of the sort of going on a human factors course for a day, 2 days, even a week, you know, and then dabbling. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a sort of recognition that this is a discipline. What is your hope for human factors engineering in supporting patient safety, healthcare quality improvement in the coming sort of decade?
Helping people understand that our discipline is very wide. You know, I mean, I do a lot of things in human factors and ergonomics, but there are areas where, you know, I don't know a lot. And so it's a very diverse discipline. I remind people that the Handbook of Human Factors and Ergonomics is a couple of thousands of pages. And you also talked about how to really integrate that knowledge. And, you know, there is a lot of discussion and a number of people have been involved in those discussions of how to embed human factors professionals in healthcare. And, you know, the UK HFE Institute has put a lot of effort into that. We also need to figure out how to help them, you know. Years ago, there was a couple of our former students who, with other human factors professionals embedded in healthcare, created that network. And because very often in a healthcare organization, you may have one person with human factors training, and there's so much that they can do that they can help with. And I'm also a strong believer in them telling us in academia what we should look at. You know, it's not just me, I've done XYZ and I'm going to tell you how to do XYZ, but you in healthcare, whether you're a human factors professional or safety professional, tell us what you think are some of the big challenges that we can do research on that we don't know enough about.
That's wonderful. I think, you know, there's been some really key threads through our conversation today around engaging with communities in all forms, working in participatory ways with them, gathering multiple perspectives, both on the problem, but also on the effectiveness of the communication, and curiosity. Yes. That actually the work is never done, because a system is only ever, you can only ever describe a system as a snapshot, and it moves and changes, and it's a evolution in and of itself. So constant kind of curiosity and inquiry, I think, has come across hugely The one sort of question I'd like to leave with is for our listeners, based on your career and experience to date, what is the one thing that you hope that they take from our conversation today?
Thinking in system and learning. I mean, I think it's that concept of learning, you know, it's individual learning and organizational learning. And we're never done. I mean, I think we didn't talk much about that concept of continuous design. It's being in that state of mind. And so thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts today.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. I do actually have one cheeky final question. So as a woman who's lived in both the US and in Europe, what's your favorite side of the Atlantic?
It depends.
That's it's complicated.
That's the system. That's the systems thinker. No, it depends. Both. But right now, the southern part of France is excellent.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute delight to speak to you today, Pascal.
Thank you, Jane.
Thanks for listening. We hope you have enjoyed this episode and do check out the others in this 6-part series. The series is funded by the National Institute for Health and Care Research and brought to you by the Patient Safety Research Collaboration in Yorkshire and Humber. The views expressed by the guests are their own and do not represent those of the NIHR or the Department of Health and Social Care.